This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia by Craig Unger. Read for you by Jason Culp. In memory of Paul Klebnikov, Alexander Litvinenko, Sergei Magnitsky, Anna Politkovskaya, and the dozens of other journalists, investigators, and dissidents who lost their lives investigating Putin's kleptocracy. It's wonderful that the Iron Curtain is gone, but it was a shield for the West. Now we've opened the gates, and this is very dangerous for the world. America is getting Russian criminals. Nobody will have the resources to stop them. You people in the West don't know our mafia yet. You will. You will. Boris Urov, former chief investigator of major crimes for the Russian Attorney General, circa 1993. Russia has never tried to use leverage over me. I have nothing to do with Russia. No deals, no loans, no nothing. Donald Trump, January 11th, 2017, via Twitter. Chapter 1. Virtual World War III. At approximately 9:32 a.m. Moscow time on November 9th, 2016, Deputy Vyacheslav Nikonov of the pro-Putin United Russia Party stepped up to the microphone in the Russian State Duma, the Russian equivalent of the House of Representatives, to make a highly unusual announcement. The grandson of Vyacheslav Molotov, the coolly ruthless Stalinist of Molotov cocktail fame, Nikonov had been involved in Soviet and Russian politics for roughly 40 years, including serving a stint on Vladimir Putin's staff. Now he was about to make a rather simple, understated announcement that, in its way, was as historic and incendiary as anything his grandfather had ever done. "Dear friends, respected colleagues," Nikonov said, "3 minutes ago, Hillary Clinton admitted her defeat in U.S. presidential elections, and a second ago, Trump started his speech as an elected president of the United States of America, and I congratulate you on this." Even though Nikonov did not add what many in the Kremlin already knew, his brief statement was greeted by enthusiastic applause. Donald J. Trump had just become Vladimir Putin's man in the White House. This book tells the story of one of the greatest intelligence operations in history, an undertaking decades in the making, through which the Russian mafia and Russian intelligence operatives successfully targeted, compromised, and implanted either a willfully ignorant or an inexplicably unaware Russian asset in the White House as the most powerful man on earth. In doing so, without firing a shot, the Russians helped put in power a man who would immediately begin to undermine the Western alliance, which has been the foundation of American national security for more than 70 years, who would start massive trade wars with America's longtime allies, fuel right-wing anti-immigrant populism, and assault the rule of law in the United States. In short, at a time at which the United States was confronted with a new form of warfare, hybrid war consisting of cyber warfare, hacking, disinformation, and the like, the United States would have at its helm a man who would leave the country all but defenseless, and otherwise inadvertently do the bidding of the Kremlin. It is a story that is difficult to tell, even though, in many ways, Donald Trump's ties to Russia over the last four decades have been an open secret, hiding in plain sight. One reason they went largely unnoticed for so long may be that aspects of them are so unsettling, so transgressive, that Americans are loath to acknowledge the dark realities staring them in the face. As a result, The exact words for what happened often give way to fierce semantic disputes. Whatever Russia did with regard to the 2016 presidential campaign, was it an assault on America's sovereignty or merely meddling? Was it an act of war? Did Russian interference change the results of the 2016 presidential election? Was it treason? Is Donald Trump a traitor, a Russian agent, or merely a so-called useful idiot who somehow, through willful blindness or colossal ignorance, does not even know how he has been compromised by Russia? President Donald Trump, of course, has denied having anything to do with Russia, having tweeted 10 days before his inauguration, "Russia has never tried to use leverage over me. I have nothing to do with Russia. No deals, no loans, no nothing." But as this book will show, over the last 4 decades, President Donald Trump and his associates have had significant ties to at least 59 people who facilitated business between Trump and the Russians, including relationships with dozens who have alleged ties to the Russian mafia. It will show that President Trump has allowed Trump-branded real estate to be used as a vehicle that likely served to launder enormous amounts of money, perhaps billions of dollars, for the Russian mafia for more than 3 decades. It will show that President Trump provided an operational home for oligarchs close to the Kremlin and some of the most powerful figures in the Russian mafia in Trump Tower, his personal and professional home, the crown jewel of his real estate empire, and other Trump buildings on and off for much of that period. It will show that during this period, the Russian mafia has likely been a de facto state actor serving the Russian Federation in much the same way that American intelligence services serve the United States, and that many of the people connected to Trump had strong ties to the Russian FSB, the state security service that is the successor to the feared KGB. It will show that President Trump has been a person of interest to Soviet and Russian intelligence for more than 40 years, and was likely the subject of one or more operations that produced kompromat, compromising materials, on him regarding sexual activities. It will show that for decades, Russian operatives, including key figures in the Russian mafia, studiously examined the weak spots in America's pay-for-play political culture, from gasoline distribution to Wall Street, from campaign finance to how the K Street lobbyists of Washington ply their trade, and having done so, hired powerful white-shoe lawyers, lobbyists, accountants, and real estate developers by the score, in an effort to compromise America's electoral system, legal process, and financial institutions. It will show that President Trump, far from being the only potential asset targeted by the Russians, was one of dozens of politicians, most of them Republicans, but some Democrats as well, and businessmen who became indebted to Russia, and that millions of dollars have been flowing from individuals and companies from, or with ties to, Russia to GOP politicians, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, for more than 20 years. It will show that the most powerful figures in America's national security, including 2 FBI directors, William Sessions and Louis Freeh, and special counsel to the CIA, Mitchell Rogovin, ended up working with Russians who had been deemed serious threats to the United States. It will show that President Trump was $4 billion in debt when Russian money came to his rescue and bailed him out, and as a result, he was and remains deeply indebted to them for reviving his business career and launching his new life in politics. It will show that President Trump partnered with a convicted felon named Felix Sater, who allegedly had ties to the Russian mob, and that Trump did not disclose the fact Sater was a criminal and profited from that relationship. And it will show that now that he is Commander-in-Chief of the United States, President Trump, as former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper put it, is in effect an intelligence asset serving Russian President Vladimir Putin or even worse, as Glenn Carl, a former CIA national intelligence officer, told Newsweek, "My assessment is that Trump is actually working directly for the Russians." Then again, maybe James Comey put it best. In January 2017, just a week after Donald Trump was inaugurated, the president invited then-FBI Director Comey to the White House for a private dinner. Characterizing Trump as unethical and untethered to truth, likening his behavior to that of a mafia boss, Comey writes in A Higher Loyalty that Trump told him, "I need loyalty. I expect loyalty." The demand reminded Comey of a Cosa Nostra induction ceremony, with Trump in the role of the mafia family boss. "The encounter left me shaken," he writes. "I had never seen anything like it in the Oval Office. As I found myself thrust into the Trump orbit, I once again was having flashbacks to my earlier career as a prosecutor against the mob. The silent circle of assent, the boss in complete control, the loyalty oaths, the us versus them worldview, the lying about all things, large and small, in service to some code of loyalty that put the organization above morality and above the truth." Comey writes as if the mafia conceit is a metaphor, but in a way, it is more than that. What follows is the story of Trump's four-decade-long relationship with the Russian mafia and the Russian intelligence operation that helped put him into the White House. On June 23, 2017, 6 months after his inauguration, President Donald Trump tweeted that his predecessor, Barack Obama, knew far in advance about Russia's meddling in the American election. The tweet was unusual in that it represented a rare acknowledgement by the president that Russia may have interfered in the 2016 election, but it was accompanied by Trump's denunciation of any investigation into the matter as a witch hunt. At the time, Russian President Vladimir Putin, who was en route to the Crimean Peninsula, which Russia had annexed in 2014 from Ukraine, had reason to be grateful for any cover provided by his American friend. His stopover was not a popular one, rekindling as it did animosity in Ukraine, whose foreign ministry issued a statement saying that Kiev considered this visit to be a gross violation of the sovereignty of the state and the territorial integrity of Ukraine. It was an issue that loomed large in the shadow play between the two men. Putin's apparent support of Trump seemingly went hand in hand with the latter's acquiescence on Russian aggression in Ukraine. While Putin and Trump hogged the headlines, however, something took place in Devens, Massachusetts that seemed light years removed from the Trump-Russia scandal, but in fact was closely tied to its origins. John Sonny Franzese, the oldest federal prisoner in the United States, was discharged from the Federal Medical Center after serving an 8-year sentence for extortion. Thanks to his age, Franzese had just celebrated his 100th birthday. His release was duly noted all over the world, from Der Spiegel to the New York Post, which dutifully called forth Franzese's glory days, hanging out with Frank Sinatra and boxing champ Jake LaMotta at the Copacabana. An underboss in the feared Colombo crime family, Franzese had repeatedly dodged murder charges because he was likely so good at making bodies disappear. But after one acquittal, he was caught on tape explaining how he'd disposed of the bodies of the dozens of people he had killed. "Dismember victim in kiddie pool, cook body parts in microwave, stuff parts in garbage disposal, be patient." Franzese was old school mafia, a relic from the mid-20th century era of the Cosa Nostra's five families, the same warring tribes depicted in The Godfather, and his return to Brooklyn evoked that powerful mythic saga that has been so deeply imprinted in the American consciousness. Yet somehow the most enduring part of his legacy, one that will forever have its place in American history, is virtually unknown today. Through his son Michael, Sonny Franzese supervised a gasoline tax evasion scam that turned into a billion-dollar enterprise lasting for 6 years until the FBI broke it up in the mid-80s. The scandal also had far-reaching geopolitical consequences in that it gave the newly arrived Russian mafia its first major score in America and positioned it to play a vital role in Donald Trump's rise to power, such a vital role that it is fair to say that without the Russian mafia's move into New York, Donald Trump would not have become president of the United States. The terms Russian mafia and ROC, Russian organized crime, though not geographically correct, are widely used by law enforcement authorities to refer to organized crime from all the republics of the former Soviet Union, not just the Russian Federation. Born in Naples in 1917, Sonny Franzese had immigrated to the United States with his family as a child, and in his youth rode shotgun on his father's bakery truck in Brooklyn. As recounted in Michael Franzese's Blood Covenant, he began his ascent back when mafia nightlife meant dining at the Stork Club on West 58th Street in Manhattan, Sherman Billingsley's swanky refuge for cafe society, where Sonny courted and married the coat check girl and spent his evenings hanging out with the likes of Grace Kelly, Marilyn Monroe, Ernest Hemingway, Damon Runyon, and Walter Winchell. Before long, the Franzeses became an integral part of the storied Colombo crime family, the youngest and perhaps the most violent of the five families of organized crime, which were locked in an epic and ongoing internecine war. The five families were the Colombos, the Gambinos, the Bonanos, the Lucchese's, and the Genoveses. When it came to bringing in revenue for the Colombo family, Sonny handled bookmaking, loan sharking, prostitution, shakedowns, and tax cheating. A thuggish, bull-necked man known for his boxer's flattened nose, he was said to resemble boxer Rocky Graziano. Over time, he became a lean, meticulously groomed don, sporting all the requisite sartorial flourishes of his profession. Crisp fedora, diamond pinky ring, pointed black shoes, bespoke suits, and a beautifully tailored overcoat. Meanwhile, he commanded half a dozen lieutenants, each of whom had as many as 30 soldiers in their organizations, and carved out a reputation as a ferocious enforcer. He swam in the biggest ocean and was the biggest, meanest, most terrifying shark in that ocean, said Phil Steinberg, a close friend of Sonny's who was a major figure in the music industry. He was an enforcer, and he did what he did better than anyone. As his son Michael put it, Sonny could paralyze the most fearless hitman with a stare. Sometimes he went significantly further than that. In 1974, a Colombo soldier who had been a bit too attentive to Sonny's wife was found buried in a cellar with a garrote around his neck. According to Vanity Fair, the man's genitals had been stuffed in his mouth, an act that authorities characterized as an apparent signal of Sonny's displeasure. As underboss, Sonny was in line to run the entire Colombo organization, and with Michael under his tutelage, the Franzeses sought opportunities in new sectors of the burgeoning entertainment industry that were opening up to the mob. They financed Deep Throat, Linda Lovelace's infamous porno film. They backed Phil Steinberg's Kama Sutra Buddha Records, which provided opportunities for money laundering and payola, not to mention hits by The Love and Spoonful, The Shangri-Las, and Gladys Knight and the Pips, among others. Before long, Michael had become a Colombo copper regime like his father, the youngest person on Fortune magazine's 50 Biggest Mafia Bosses list, and one of the biggest earners in the mafia since Al Capone. By the early 80s, however, organized crime in New York was undergoing a paradigmatic shift for a reason that was not yet widely known. The Russians were coming. In fact, Russians had begun collaborating with Italian mobsters as early as 1980, when the two crime organizations partnered in one of the most lucrative government ripoffs in American history. At the time, Michael Franzese, then in his early 30s, was already providing protection to a mobster named Lawrence Iorizzo, who owned or supplied 300 gas stations in and around Long Island and New Jersey, and was making a fortune by skimming tax revenue from gasoline sales. This scam was possible thanks to the sluggishness with which laggardly government officials collected gas taxes. Together, federal, state, and local authorities demanded on average 27 cents out of every gallon that was sold, but they took their time in collecting, sometimes as much as a year. Having registered dozens of shell companies in Panama as owners of the gas stations, all Iorizzo had to do was to close down each of his gas stations before the tax man came, and then reopen under new management with a different shell company. By the time the tax men came looking for their money, much of it was in Iorizzo's pocket. When the FBI later investigated the scam, which had spread to six states, they called the investigation Operation Red Daisy. Iorizzo's scheme was going swimmingly, except for one thing. A group of men, Michael Franzese described them as small fry associates of another family, were trying to muscle in on Iorizzo's operation. According to Franzese, the 6'4", 450-pound Iorizzo ate pizzas the way most people eat Ritz crackers, and didn't exactly look like he needed protection. Nevertheless, he had gone to Franzese for help with the small-time hoods, who were trying to shake him down and move in on his territory. Without missing a beat, Franzese figured out a mutually acceptable solution, and a highly lucrative partnership was born. Soon, so much money was pouring in that Franzese was promoted to cap regime in the Cosa Nostra. Then, in 1984, three alleged Russian gangsters, David Bogatin, Michael Markovits, and Lev Persitz, approached him with a proposition that was very similar to Iorizzo's. Like Iorizzo, they had their own gas tax scam going on, and like Iorizzo, they needed protection. Franzese instantly saw the opportunity for another huge score, but he sized up the Russians with a mixture of respect and scorn. Bogatin, with his receding hairline and steel-rimmed glasses, looked more like a white-collar professional than a Russian mobster. His father had spent 18 years in prison in Siberia because he had been caught hanging the key to the office door so that it accidentally covered a portrait of Joseph Stalin, thereby defacing the image of the Soviet dictator. In 1966, Bogatin joined the Soviet Army and served in a North Vietnamese anti-aircraft unit, where he helped shoot down American pilots. Then, in the mid-1970s, after leaving the Army, he began working as a printer, but was fired because he was printing outlawed material for Jewish dissidents. After being blacklisted by the KGB, in 1977, Bogatin clawed his way out of Russia, came to New York, and worked in a factory. He bought a car, mastered English, and began to run a private cab service. That led to a gas station, then a fuel distributorship, all while he made acquaintances among the Russian diaspora. Having grown up under communism, Bogatin took to capitalism like a duck to water, which won Franzese's respect. The Russians had been among the pioneers of this spectacularly lucrative scam, and they had about 200 members working under them. They wanted to flex their muscles, Franzese said, in testimony before a Senate subcommittee in 1996, and would not hesitate to resort to violence when they felt it was necessary to do so. Franzese had a harder time taking Bogatin's partner seriously, thanks largely to his attire. Michael Markovits wore gaudy jewelry, heavy gold chains, and showy, wide-collared shirts unbuttoned to the navel. As Franzese saw it, Markovits aspired to be John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever, but instead called to mind the shimmying, wild and crazy guys played by Steve Martin and Dan Aykroyd on Saturday Night Live in the 70s. The dapper Franzese couldn't stop laughing at him. Markowitz looked like a rug salesman who had just hit the lottery. Was this really his competition? In the end, however, money trumped fashion, and so, on a Saturday morning in the fall of 1980, Michael Franzese sat down with Begotten, Persitz, and Markowitz at a gas station in Brooklyn. These Russians, though he worked with Russian gangsters and was often identified as Russian, Markowitz was actually Romanian, were having trouble collecting money owed them, Franzese recalled. They were also having problems obtaining and holding on to the licenses they needed to keep the gas tax scam going. Franzese could help on both counts. One of his soldiers was a guy named Vinny, and as Franzese put it, Vinny's job was to say, pay the money or I'll break your legs. Vinny was persuasive, so persuasive that the Colombo family had become famous for getting people to pay their debts. That wasn't all. Franzese also had operatives inside the state government who could provide the Russians with the wholesale licenses they needed to defraud the government. The Russians desperately needed Franzese, and he knew just how to play them. We agreed to share the illegal proceeds, 75% my end, 25% their end, he said. The deal was put on record with all five crime families, and I took care of the Colombo family's share of the illegal proceeds out of my end. Soon, the money came pouring in, $5 million to more than $8 million a week. As the operation expanded, profits soared to $100 million a month, more than $1 billion a year. The Italians were the big winners, but Markowitz and Begotten were well on their way to lucrative criminal careers. Thus, in 1984, at the peak of his success, David Begotten went shopping for apartments in New York City. Even though he was a junior partner with Franzese, after 7 years in New York, Begotten had stashed away enough money to buy real estate anywhere he wanted. For roughly a decade, thousands of Russian Jews like him had been pouring into Brighton Beach, Brooklyn. But Begotten had his eyes on something more prestigious. So instead of shopping for a home in Brighton Beach, Begotten became fixated on a garish 58-story edifice in Midtown Manhattan, with mirrors and brass and gold-plated fixtures everywhere. A monument to conspicuous consumption, it had an atrium covered with pink, white-veined marble near the entrance, and a 60-foot waterfall overlooking a suspended walkway, luxury shops, and cafes. The AIA Guide to New York City described it as fantasy land for the affluent shopper, but hastened to add that the design was more like a generic malt liquor than posh champagne. The New York Times architecture critic, Ada Louise Huxtable, called it monumentally undistinguished, while another Times writer dismissed it as preposterously lavish and showy, even pretentious. The developer's love of excess was such that he purposely overstated the number of floors in the building. That way, he could say he lived on the 68th floor, even though it was a 58-story building. Its address was 721 Fifth Avenue, and it was known as Trump Tower. Chapter 2. Trump's Beautiful Laundrette. According to the late Wayne Barrett, who investigated the Begotten deal for the Village Voice, Donald Trump himself took the unusual step of personally meeting with David Begotten when the transaction took place. Apparently, Trump found nothing untoward in the fact that Begotten was buying not one, but five luxury condos in Trump Tower for a total of $6 million, the equivalent of approximately $14.5 million in 2018, even though he had no legitimate way to get his hands on that much cash and had arrived in America with just $3 in his pockets. There was also one more element in the deal that was highly irregular. The extraordinary hype enveloping the building's glamour overshadowed the fact that Trump Tower offered a special feature that was exceedingly rare. At the time, according to author David K. Johnston, Trump Tower was one of only two buildings in New York City that sold condos to buyers who used shell companies, such as limited liability corporations, which allowed purchasers to buy real estate while concealing their identities. If you are doing a transaction with no mortgage, there is no financial institution that needs to know where the money came from, particularly if it's a wire transfer from overseas, said Jonathan Weiner, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Law Enforcement in the Clinton administration. The customer obligations that are imposed on all kinds of financial institutions are not imposed on people selling real estate. They should have been, but they weren't. So, thanks to these lax regulations, Trump began to sell condos in Trump Tower as an ideal vehicle through which criminals could put their dirty money into luxury condominiums while keeping their ownership anonymous. Thus, according to the New York State Attorney General's office, when Trump closed the deal for 5 apartments with David Bogatin, whether he knew it or not, he had just helped launder money for the Russian mafia. All of this was happening at an extraordinary time. It was 1984. After nearly 40 years, the balance of power in the Cold War had tilted decisively toward the West. The USSR was still embroiled in a costly, bloody, and unproductive war in Afghanistan, the Soviet Vietnam, as it had been since 1979, leaving the Soviet economy in tatters. President Ronald Reagan had aggressively ramped up the arms race with Star Wars, the Strategic Defense Initiative, which was intended to shield the U.S. against incoming missiles and succeeded in making the cost of being a superpower prohibitively expensive. Some people in the KGB were beginning to realize that the Soviet Union's economy was doomed. Finally, with the deaths of Soviet leaders Leonid Brezhnev in 1982 and Yuri Andropov in 1984, and the ascent of aging and ailing Konstantin Chernenko to the top spot in the Soviet leadership, the old party structures were failing. All of which created a gigantic power vacuum for the Russian mafia to fill at a time when it had grown to roughly 9,000 criminal gangs with 35,000 members, many of whom, likely including Bogatin, were looking to transfer illicit funds into safe havens in the West. Two powerful forces in a newly created global underground economy had begun to come together. On the one hand, the disintegration of the Soviet Union had opened a fire hose-like torrent of hundreds of billions of dollars in flight capital that began to pour forth from oligarchs, wealthy apparatchiks, and mobsters in Russia and its satellites. On the other hand, Donald Trump's zeal to sell condos, no questions asked, to shell companies meant that Russians could launder vast amounts of money while hiding their personal identities. Over the next 30 years, dozens of lawyers, accountants, real estate agents, mortgage brokers, and other white-collar professionals came together to facilitate such transactions on a massive scale. As the Financial Times notes, the fact that the U.S. and the U.K., unlike most Western democracies, permit anonymous ownership of real estate facilitates money laundering of roughly $300 billion per year in the United States alone, most of it from Russia. As a result, luxury real estate has provided a haven for Russian oligarchs and their kleptocratic president, Vladimir Putin, son of a factory worker and Russian seaman, to stash billions of dollars. All cash purchases through shell companies are not in and of themselves illegal or improper, and they have become more common in recent years in luxury home sales all over the world. Nor are sellers under any obligation to question where a buyer's money comes from. However, Trump appears to have taken advantage of these weak regulations to sell en masse to the Russians. Because it is so difficult to penetrate the shell companies that purchased these condos, it is almost impossible for reporters, or for that matter anyone without subpoena power, to ascertain the scale at which such laundering may have taken place in Trump-branded properties. Nevertheless, according to a BuzzFeed investigation by Thomas Frank, more than 1,300 condos, one-fifth of all Trump-branded condos sold in the U.S. since the 80s, were sold in secretive, all-cash transactions that enable buyers to avoid legal scrutiny by shielding their finances and identities. The BuzzFeed article added that the total value of these condo sales, sales that match the U.S. Treasury's criteria for possible money laundering, was about $1.5 billion, a figure that actually may understate the amount of dirty money in play. The article did not include Trump's many buildings outside the United States, such as Trump-branded high-rises in Canada, the Philippines, Panama, Uruguay, Turkey, India, South Korea, and other countries where President Trump often licenses his name and collects royalties. As a teenager, Donald Trump had helped out in Trump Village, a Brighton Beach-adjacent development in Coney Island his father had built, in fact, the only Trump real estate development named after Fred Trump rather than Donald, by collecting money from the washing machines in the shared laundry used by Russian emigres and the like, in the form of nickels, dimes, and quarters. Now he was participating in a very different kind of laundering operation, and this time the scale of the money was monumental. David Begotten fled the United States in 1987 to avoid prosecution for his gas tax scam and was extradited from Poland 5 years later. When he returned, he was imprisoned for the scam, but it remains unclear whether or not Trump knew about the illicit source of Begotten's money. Still, over the next four decades, similar transactions took place in Trump Tower and other Trump-branded buildings so frequently that it's hard to imagine Donald Trump had no knowledge whatsoever about what was going on. Begotten may have been the first Russian to use Trump condos to launder money, but other criminals with ties to the Italian mob had already done the same. Indeed, Lucchese crime family associate Robert Hopkins, who ran one of New York's biggest illegal gambling operations, bought his Trump Tower apartments in 1981, 2 years before the building opened. When he met Trump at the closing, he opened his briefcase and approximately $200,000 in cash spilled out on Trump's conference table. Similarly, soon after Trump Tower opened in 1983, Italian financier Roberto Polo, who was subsequently jailed for embezzlement, bought six Trump Tower apartments in the names of offshore shell companies. And Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier, the brutal and corrupt former leader of Haiti, bought an apartment on the 54th floor in August of 1983. Still, Begotten's purchase of five apartments in Trump Tower was unique in that it did nothing less than link the future president of the United States to murderous Russian mafiosi and their subculture of drugs, money laundering, extortion rackets, prostitution, and more. Even more important, the transaction may have represented an initial contact from Soviet intelligence to see if Trump was a potential Soviet asset or agent of influence. Within the world of intelligence, assets are persons within countries being spied upon who provide intelligence to a foreign power. Different categories of assets include those who elect to work for a foreign government because they prefer its ideology, those who betray their country for monetary gain, those who are being blackmailed, and so-called useful idiots who don't even know they are being used, but who still provide valuable information through security lapses or blind pursuit of their own agendas. When he was asked about the Begotten-Trump transaction, Oleg Kalugin, the former head of counterintelligence for the KGB, said he was not surprised. That's typical. Normally, the procedures of major intelligence and secret police organizations are intended to collect sufficient information to see if the guy will collaborate, he added. If he is willing to collaborate, he may be useful. At the time, the KGB was deeply concerned about its failure to recruit more American assets and had issued instructions to agents abroad to find U.S. targets to cultivate. In Trump, the Soviets had discovered a man who was so intoxicated by a huge new clientele with boatloads of cash that he engaged in dubious transactions without asking questions. Doing business with Trump allowed the Russian mafia to secure a significant new foothold in the United States and begin an offensive that continues to assault America's most essential democratic institutions to this day. Moreover, as early as 1984, the Russians had discovered that as long as they had money, Donald Trump was listening. All of which made Trump, initially at least, a tiny part of an historic conflict that began as blowback from the end of the Cold War. For Vladimir Putin, the demise of the Soviet Union had been the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century. But even that was exacerbated by what came next. One by one, no fewer than 13 Eastern Bloc nations joined NATO. In 1999, Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic joined NATO, followed by Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, and Slovenia, shortly before the 2004 Istanbul summit. They were subsequently joined by Albania, Croatia, and most recently Montenegro. And that does not count East Germany, which of course became part of NATO when it reunited with West Germany. Putin, however, drew a line in the sand with regard to Ukraine. After the Euromaidan protests against Russian aggression began in Ukraine in 2013, Russia launched a massive global offensive in which its strategic goals were to weaken not only the United States, but Britain, NATO, the European Union, and indeed the entire Western alliance. The battle was against not just the United States, but the West itself, as Russia repeatedly interceded in domestic politics in the United Kingdom, where it fueled the successful Brexit campaign in which UK citizens voted to leave the European Union, in the Netherlands, where it backed Geert Wilders, in France, where it supported Marine Le Pen, in Ukraine, where it backed Viktor Yanukovych and other pro-Putin forces, and in Hungary, Poland, and elsewhere in Eastern Europe as well. The most striking fact of this massive new global conflict, however, may have been that barely anyone noticed that it was taking place. It was extraordinary. War is generally defined as armed conflict. However, Vladimir Putin had attacked the sovereignty of America and other Western nations, a virtual World War III, if you like, but almost no one reported on it in the newspapers, on TV, on the radio, or on the internet. That's because this was a war by other means, a war that eschewed the bombs, bullets, and boots on the ground of conventional warfare, and instead relied on a new, sophisticated, asymmetric, hybrid form of nonlinear warfare. Only on rare occasions did Russia resort to old-fashioned military intervention, as it did in 2014 when Russian troops were a prelude to the annexation of the Crimea during the Ukraine crisis. Instead, Putin waged a shadow war, or virtual war, consisting of covert operations, disinformation, and cyber warfare. It was a war in which Russia hacked its adversaries, used third parties, such as Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, to make it seem as if leaks had emanated from heroic, highly principled whistleblowers rather than Russian intelligence, hijacked social media and exploited algorithms to make highly provocative fake news go viral, transformed Facebook into one of the biggest purveyors of Russian propaganda on the planet, deliberately used not only alternative facts and fake news, but bogus websites that pretended to correct fake news, and in the process, upended the very notion of truth, of reality itself, of what is real. Of course, all of this did not go entirely unnoticed, but in Russia, investigative journalists, rogue intelligence agents, and opposition politicians who revealed the truth inevitably faced brutal reprisals. In 2000, Paul Klebnikov published Godfather of the Kremlin, The Decline of Russia in the Age of Gangster Capitalism, in which he compared Russian oligarch Boris Berezovsky to a Sicilian mafioso. 4 years later, having just become the editor of Forbes' Russian edition, Klebnikov published a list of the 100 richest Russians and was shot and killed by unknown assailants. Similarly, Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya, Alexander Litvinenko, a former officer of the Russian Federal Security Service, FSB, and KGB, who had blamed Putin for ordering Politkovskaya's assassination, and Sergei Magnitsky, a Russian lawyer and auditor representing Bill Browder's Hermitage Capital Management, are just a few of the scores of people who died mysteriously after investigating the alleged crimes of Putin and his oligarchs. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, at least 58 journalists have been murdered in Russia since the demise of the Soviet Union in 1991. The figure goes up to 82 deaths, if one includes those for which a motive has not been confirmed. These figures do not include the murders of Alexander Litvinenko or other people who were killed outside Russia, and who, also like Litvinenko, were investigating corruption in Russia outside the context of journalism. As a key component of this battle, Vladimir Putin used a secret weapon that few Americans understood. While the Italian mafia in the U.S. exists largely to serve its own interests, in Russia things were different. Where Americans cracked down on organized crime, Putin co-opted it. He weaponized it. Russian gangsters became, in effect, Putin's enforcers. This is not merely a metaphor. As Oleg Kalugin, former head of counterintelligence for the KGB, told me, in effect, the mafia is one of the branches of the Russian government today. All of which means that since coming to power first as prime minister in 1999 and then as president in 2000, Putin's greatest triumph is his extraordinary command over a mafia state, a political system that is effectively a government of, by, and for organized crime. As author Karen DeWisha explains in Putin's Kleptocracy, the mafia had come together with former KGB officials and the political and economic elites, combining their money and power to forge the basis for Putin's authoritarian kleptocracy, a kleptocracy that ushered in an era of global theft on an unimaginable level and has reportedly made Vladimir Putin the richest man in the world, with wealth, according to Hermitage Capital Management CEO Bill Browder, approaching $200 billion. As a result of this unfathomable greed, untold billions that ordinarily would have been spent on education, transportation, healthcare, and other services in Russia and its trading partners have been stashed in offshore bank accounts, hedge funds, and luxury condos for Putin and his cronies, who were allowed to make billions through drug trafficking, extortion, elaborate financial schemes, the sex trade, arms deals, and the like, on just one fundamental condition. They work within Putin's rules to further his strategic goals. They were then free to compromise persons of influence in the West via various forms of kompromat that documented money laundering, illicit sexual trysts, and other potential scandals, provided that they serve his political agenda, that they act as intelligence operatives, that they recruit assets, that they collect intelligence on persons of interest, In effect, they became geopolitical weapons against the West. Putin's ascent is best described not by old-school Kremlinologists, but as former world chess champion Garry Kasparov explains in Winter is Coming, by the achievements of Don Vito Corleone, the web of betrayals, the secrecy, and the blurred lines between what is business, what is government, and what is criminal. It's all there in Mario Puzo's books, a strict hierarchy, extortion, intimidation, a tough guy image, a long string of convenient deaths among leading critics, eliminating traitors, the code of secrecy and loyalty, and above all, a mandate to keep the revenue flowing. In other words, it was a mafia, which was something Donald Trump knew a lot about. Chapter 3. Married to the Mob. Donald Trump was no virgin when it came to organized crime. In fact, the Trump family had a taste for it, dating back three generations. It began at the tail end of the 19th century, when a rogue entrepreneur who happened to become Donald Trump's grandfather headed out for Canada's Yukon Territory during the Klondike Gold Rush and sought to make his fortune not by panning for gold, but by providing essential services for gold miners. According to author Gwenda Blair, among the various enterprises owned by Frederick, nay Friedrich, Trump, was a restaurant sometimes called the Dairy Restaurant and sometimes called the Poodle Dog, which advertised private rooms for ladies, a polite euphemism for prostitution. A generation later, Fred Trump, the son of Frederick and Donald's father, started out building single-family houses in Queens and then became wealthy thanks to windfall profits from building government-backed housing in Brooklyn and Queens. Fred's influence was particularly conspicuous in the Brooklyn neighborhoods of Brighton Beach and Coney Island. Brighton Beach had a marvelous sandy coast looking out on the Atlantic and the adjacent Coney Island amusement park, all just 10 miles from Manhattan. Everything one could ask for in a delightful seaside resort. Unfortunately, it had become scarred by the egregious urban renewal policies of New York master builder Robert Moses, which transformed parts of the healthy middle-class neighborhood into a festering slum. Much of this decline came from Fred Trump's projects in the area, which were tainted by scandal, misappropriation of funds, and cronyism in one form or another. New developments often led to federal hearings and investigations into Trump's business practices, allegations that Trump defrauded veterans in rental agreements, and allegations of racism. According to Coney Island historian Charles Denson, Fred Trump was so shrewd at exploiting the weak spots in federal regulations that federal laws had to be changed to prevent the kind of nefarious schemes that Trump excelled in. Fred usually got his way, but when he didn't, there was hell to pay. After being denied a zoning change in his effort to build Miami Beach-style high-rises at Coney Island's famed Steeplechase Park, Donald's father was so frustrated that he threw a party at the site and invited guests to vandalize the stained glass facade of the pavilion, knocking out the teeth of the enormous Steeplechase Funny Face, a local landmark. This sad event was a vindictive and shameful act by a grown man behaving like a juvenile delinquent. It wasn't business, it was personal, wrote Denson, asserting that it revealed a twisted personality that was unusual for even the most hard-bitten developers. Fred's projects often involved people tied to the mob, and he dealt with them with the help of Brad Zaxon, a convicted felon who had spent nearly 5 years in jail after taking a plea to dodge an attempted murder charge, and who served as Fred's consigliere and the exclusive broker for all his properties. Zaxon later worked with Donald Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort as Manafort's real estate fixer, as the real deal put it. A Fred Trump protege with a checkered past and an appetite for fanciful deals. According to the New York State Organized Crime Task Force's investigations in the 50s, a complicated web of relationships tied Fred's partner, Willie Tomasello, to both the Gambino and Genovese crime families, as well as to Lucky Luciano, a father of modern organized crime in America. In addition, when it came to getting crucial favors from City Hall insiders, such as zoning approvals, Fred relied on Kenny Sutherland, an ally of the Lucchese family, which had become enormously powerful in city and state politics. Meanwhile, even in high school at New York Military Academy, Donald was so obsessed with money that he bragged about his father's wealth. He pegged it at $30 million, and boasted that it doubled every year. He was already focused on the future, thinking long-term more than present, said his roommate, David Smith. He used to talk about his dad's business, how he would use him as a role model, but go one step further. In his spare time, Donald worked enough with his father to learn the real estate game, running errands, hosing down construction sites, and collecting those coins from the laundry rooms at the 7 high-rises his father called Trump Village. In the end, however, Donald saw his father's vision as severely limited by the humble outer boroughs of New York, and desperately wanted to take things further. "I want to be in mid-Manhattan, where all the top stuff is going on," he said early on in his career. "I'll never be involved with the old man's property, except when he needs me." Determined to leave behind the more modest world of Brooklyn and Queens, in the mid-70s, Donald, then still in his 20s, reached across the East River for the brass ring, Manhattan. By that time, however, New York City had hit rock bottom. Manufacturing had fled the city. Crime was soaring. By the spring of 1975, the city had an operating deficit of at least $750 million and a debt level of more than $11 billion, and its credit had been exhausted. In October 1975, President Gerald Ford declared he would veto any bill that called for a federal bailout to save New York from bankruptcy. An unforgettable and iconic headline in the New York Daily News put it succinctly: "Ford to City. Drop dead." For Donald Trump, the fact that the entire city was on the verge of bankruptcy was good news indeed, because prices could not go much lower. For his option to buy the dilapidated, rat-infested Commodore Hotel on East 42nd Street, Trump paid exactly $1. Decrepit though it was, the Commodore had two things going for it. First, it was adjacent to Grand Central Terminal, a spectacular location, if the city came back to life. And second, because the property was so big, the upside was potentially colossal in a city valued by the square foot. It was the opportunity of a lifetime. Helping Trump navigate the perilous waters necessary to get the political support and legal tax abatements to consummate the deal was none other than Roy Cohn, Trump's mentor and role model, the ruthless, heavy-lidded attorney who served as a brutal and pitiless fixer for establishment fixtures, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and Rupert Murdoch, among others, and mobsters alike, Anthony Fat Tony Salerno, Carmine Galante, and John Gotti. An iconic figure who truly embodied the dark side of his era, Cohn has been dead for more than 3 decades, but still casts a long shadow over American politics. Cohn won notoriety as the hatchet man for Senator Joe McCarthy, the red-baiting demagogue of the 50s, leading McCarthy's aggressive, prosecutorial witch hunt against alleged communists. One of his most infamous Red Scare triumphs took place during the trial of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, who were convicted of espionage in 1951. Cohn's great feat was to succeed in bullying David Greenglass to testify against his sister, Ethel Rosenberg. Later, Greenglass admitted he had lied on the stand at Cohn's insistence, when he testified that his sister typed notes that were sent to the Soviets. As a result of his testimony, Ethel was executed in the electric chair. One of several cases